I said we'd talk from the Bible about what we've just done and why we have done what we did and not what perhaps some people expected us to do. Historically, this sort of situation, we would all have been focused around the font at the back. If you don't know what a font is, the clever ones will say, well, that's what you use in your word processor, isn't it? It's Times New Roman or Arial. Well, strictly speaking, that's a fount, F-O-U-N-T. And font, F-O-N-T, is the American spelling. But the font that I'm talking about is that stone thing at the back in front of the amplifier, which has a bowl carved into it, and it's for putting water in, and it's for use when people are baptized. And people think, well, surely that's what you should have done today. You should have had the child at the back, and the parents and godparents should have made certain promises, and then you should have made the sign of the cross in water or sprinkled some water onto the child's head, because that's what's always been done. Historically, that was what was done. That's what was done to me when I was 2 months old. I don't remember it vividly. I remember nothing about it at all. But this was a normal thing. It's been a normal thing for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years. Indeed, it was more than merely a nice ceremony to go through, more than just a naming ceremony, which is what people view it as these days. It was, in fact, a badge of citizenship. If you were a member of a European country, you must have been baptized. Because if you were not baptized, you were not a citizen of that country. Indeed, you were perceived as being seditious. You were perceived as being a traitor. At the time of the Reformation, there were a group of awkward people. People like me. Who said, we disagree with this. There is not a union between church and state, and so baptism, whatever baptism is, it's got nothing to do with the state. These people first appeared in Zurich in 1525, and one of them was captured and accused of treason. And this poor man, Felix Manz, they said, you are a traitor, you are seditious, because you have taught this and because you've done this, and so therefore, for treason, the crime is to be executed. And because you clearly like water so much, we'll drown you in the river. And when we were in Switzerland a few years ago, we stood at the point by the river where they trussed him up and they tossed him in, and he drowned in the river. And that's how baptism used to be perceived. They thought, if you don't baptize your children, you are a traitor to the society. Thankfully, we don't think that anymore, because I suspect there are many people here this morning who have never been baptized. And you are not going to be executed. Thankfully, you would say, since 1965, that's been abolished. Not quite. Treason, I believe, still does carry the death penalty. If you try and kill the Queen or Prince Charles, then I think still you could be executed for that. But then it became something that people thought was important to do. That in somehow having a child baptized did something to it. It gave them a start in life. It gave them an option. And I scratch my head and think, what? What does it do to give a child a good start in life? Is it an option in that, well, it saves them having a bath that day? I've never quite worked out what people actually mean when they say it gives them a good start in life, or it washes away sins. If I believed any of these things were true, then I would carry around in my pocket a water pistol. And everybody I walked past and thought, they haven't been baptized, I'd whip it out and squirt them. That would be the logic of such a view that baptism was so important, it had some positive benefit upon people. But I don't believe that, and so therefore you don't need to carry an umbrella with you in case you might bump into me one day. Indeed, if you were to do some statistical analysis, and if you were to take two groups of people, this group of people have been baptized and this group of people haven't been baptized, and you compared how many of them had become politicians, bankers, how many had become road sweepers, how many had become serial killers, how many of them had become bank robbers, you'd find that proportions were virtually the same on both sides, whether you had been baptized or not. So in what way then does baptism do something for the good of a person? When we come and look at what the Bible says, we find the Bible says something very different. We find that Jesus, going around Palestine with his disciples, would baptize people. In John chapter 4, it speaks about Jesus was making and baptizing more disciples than John the Baptist, although Jesus himself did not baptize, but only his disciples. So Jesus was going around baptizing people. But in Matthew chapter 19 that we read, then children were brought to him that he might lay hands on them and pray. He didn't baptize them. Indeed, had the disciples thought that this was the normal thing to do, to baptize the children, then surely the disciples would have been going around trying to grab as many children as possible and bring them along to Jesus to baptize them. But he didn't. They didn't. Indeed, they were sending them away. Go away. Don't bother him. The disciples rebuked the people. Don't do this. He's too busy doing other things. One of the things might be baptizing people. But Jesus said to them, let the little children come to me and do not hinder them, for to such belongs the kingdom of heaven. And he laid his hands on them, a sign of blessing, and went away. Now, we try and do what the Bible says. Now, some people start getting smart and say, ah, where does the Bible say you've got to have a building like this? Doesn't. It's a convenience. It's a convenient building to meet in. You couldn't all fit into 59 High Street. Be a bit tight, wouldn't it? So it's convenient that we meet here. Had there been more of you, we might have had a problem. Had there been 300, then some of you would have been standing outside on the grass, because we have limited capacity. But thankfully, we do have enough room and a bit more space. Other people say, you're standing in a pulpit. That's what this is, by the way. Those don't know. This is a pulpit. You're standing in a pulpit. Where does it say that in the Bible? There are people who will trawl through the Bible to find an example of a pulpit. There is one in the Old Testament. I don't use this because of that one verse. I use it because, well, it's here. It's convenient. It's got two sockets so I can plug my recording equipment into it. It means that I can see everybody easily and you can all hear me. And even though we do have amplification, some of you will be thinking, why have you got the amplifier turned on? Your voice is far too loud. There was an occasion when I preached at a church in West London when people complained that my voice was too loud. The people who complained were the deaf, because the person with the amplifier had failed to recognise the loudness of my voice, and so it was pounding through their hearing aids. There are lots of peripheral things that we do just because it's convenient, but it's not against what the Bible says. But when the Bible says this is how you should live, then that's how we seek to live. When the Bible says this is what you should do, that's what we seek to do. When the Bible says, Jesus says, welcome children and pray for God's blessing upon them, that's what we do. The Bible doesn't say welcome children and splash water in their heads, so we don't do that. We try and do what the Bible says. So anyone that wants to criticise what we've done this morning because no water was involved, then I'm sorry, but don't criticise me, criticise Jesus. We're trying to do what he did. And what he did, we think, is important because Jesus is the Son of God. Now some people will say, yeah, well that's just fairy tales. Well, it's a common myth that what the New Testament says is fairy tales. The New Testament is probably the most historically accurate book in the whole of history. It's because people don't like what it says. They've said, oh, it's a myth. It's not a myth. People have tried to write books against it and say why it's wrong, why it's not true. And several people have done this and they ended up writing books they never expected, saying, well, we tried to prove it wrong, but in fact we discovered it's true. There are several famous examples I could give you if you're interested. Other people say, yeah, but it all talks about God, and of course we know that God doesn't exist. It's difficult dealing with people like this because the whole basis of their life assumes that God exists. If there is no God, there are no morals. If there is no God, there is no right and wrong. If there is no God, it doesn't matter what you do. There's no judgment to come. There's no fear that after death you will be punished for what you've done. If you can do it and get away with it, what's the problem? Whatever you do is considered to be okay. In fact, you can't say okay because that's a value judgment. Without God, you can't make value judgments. It's interesting when you listen to people like Richard Dawkins, who are most vociferous in denying the existence of God. He gets very annoyed when people talk about God and teach about God in schools and they say, he says that's wrong. What do you mean by wrong? You're making an assumption that there are such things as morals. Where do your morals come from? You are merely a collection of atoms. That's all you are. What is the difference between you and this lump of wood? This is a collection of atoms. You're a collection of atoms. If you take a piece of wood and you smash it against another piece of wood, is that wrong? If you take that same piece of wood and smash it into someone's head, is that wrong? And you would immediately say, of course it is. But why? Atheism is irrational and foolish because God has revealed himself in our hearts. He has given us consciences. And we know what is right and wrong. What Jesus tells us here in talking about receiving little children, do not hinder them, for to such belongs the kingdom of heaven. Some people say, there you are, little children are already members of the kingdom of heaven. But it's not what he says. He says, to such, to the likes of these. What he's saying is, children are trusting. Those of you who have children, you know that your children trust you. They trust you to provide for them. They trust you to love for them. They trust you to care for them. Sadly, we have examples down through the ages of children who foolishly put their trust in their parents, and their parents have abused them. It's very sad when that happens. But the children have trusted their parents. And Jesus says, of such is the kingdom of heaven, of those who trust like they do. And he's calling upon us to trust him like children trust their parents. See, the problem is that all of us inherit our nature from our parents. When you do something wrong and your parent tells you off, you can say, in one sense, it's not a defence, but you can say, I did that wrong because of you, Dad, because of you, Mum. And the parents can say, well, I did it wrong because of my parents and my parents. We inherit what the Bible calls a sinful nature, a tendency to do things wrong. Because of conscience, that restrains us. And we are able often not to do wrong things, but we still do wrong things. And these wrong things make God angry. And we need to be forgiven, not by the people we've offended, not by the just by the people we've hurt. We also need to be forgiven by God. And God readily will forgive us if we admit that we are wrong, if we confess that we've done things wrong, and we trust in Jesus, who died to be punished for what we did wrong. We need a new start, which is why elsewhere Jesus says you must be born again. Now, by being born again, he doesn't mean that you've got to climb back into your mother's womb and be born a second time. He's talking about it in a spiritual sense, not a literal sense. You need to have a change of your heart, which God can bring about when you call upon him for forgiveness. And it doesn't matter who you are. Doesn't matter how old you are, doesn't matter how young you are, God will receive you if you come to him and trust in Jesus. Jesus said elsewhere, earlier in the Gospel of Matthew, he said these words, "Come to me, all who labour and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. He will forgive you for all the things you've done. He will change your heart, give you a new start, and a guaranteed hope of heaven to come." So instead of saying to yourself, am I going to heaven or aren't I? I hope I am. You will instead say, I know that God has forgiven me. I know I am going to heaven. Now, every Christmas we distribute leaflets and calendars and magazines to the houses of the village. If you live in the village, we will come to your door and offer you these. And the special treat this year probably is that the magazine will include an account of what happened to me 42 years ago when I became a Christian. When I realised that I was wrong and I had offended God, and God forgave me. And it was the biggest shock I've ever had in my life. And I stand today here saying this because of what God did to me then. And God can do it to you. And God can give you peace, a clear conscience, and a certainty of what is to come in the future, if you will merely come to God and say, I'm wrong, you're right, and Jesus is the one who has dealt with all my wrongdoing. Well, I hope that as a consequence of today, you'll think about this, and perhaps if you want to know more, you'll come and talk to me, or perhaps come again next week. You would be more than welcome. We will never turn you away. We will seek to do what Jesus did, and it wouldn't be just let the little children come, let anyone come, and we will seek to help you.